From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The debate over public schools and education policy can get really contentious. Most Americans disagree on how best to run a public school system, arguing over traditional schools versus charter schools, and with terms like school choice being bandied about. Today, we'll examine a specific type of school system in Chicago, a city where ninth graders can apply to the high school of their choice, just like they might for public universities. Does the system work? And how does it impact the very people who are supposed to benefit, namely students? Joining me to help answer that question is Kate Filippo, Associate Professor of Cultural and Educational Policy Studies at Loyola University Chicago School of Education. She's the author of Advisory in Urban High Schools, a Study of Expanded Teacher Roles. And she joins me to discuss her latest book called A Contest Without Winners: How Students Experience Competitive School Choice. Welcome to the program, Kate. So first, explain how Chicago's school system works for those of us who are outside Chicago. This idea that kids can apply to the school of their choice, what does that actually mean?
What I'll say is that Chicago is one of the cities where young people can apply to the school of their choice, but there are many others that come to mind are San Francisco, Baltimore, New York City, Philadelphia, and Houston. So some elements are the same across these. Some are, you know, sort of idiosyncratic depending on the city and its school district itself. So in Chicago, young people have a choice of over 130 high schools. I know it's gone up actually since my book came out, or since I did the research for my book. So young people can pick a high school of their preference they'd like to go to based on interests, based on future plans. They have a variety of schools specializing in things like performing arts. They have public military academies. There are open enrollment neighborhood schools, and there are academically selective programs and schools of different varieties. So within all that, young people have the option to apply to schools that have more people who want to attend them than they have spaces to accommodate. And that academically high performing schools often are schools that are oversubscribed. So in Chicago, young people prepare for that process if they want to apply to academically selective schools, such as they're called selective enrollment high schools in Chicago. We also have international baccalaureate programs that exist in already freestanding public high schools. So young people have their grades and standardized test scores from when they are in seventh grade inform the portfolio that's used to determine their eligibility to enter the school.
That seems awfully young to have that process start. And I'm wondering what the justification was that first created this system. Where I imagine that the language and the justification was that this would benefit poor kids.
It's interesting. We've had academically selective high schools almost as long as we've had high schools, Sonali. One of the oldest selective schools in the country is Central High School in Philadelphia. Boston Latin is another long-standing academically selective high school. We also have two in Chicago itself, Lindblom Math and Science Academy and Lane Technical High School, which have existed for just about a century. So a lot of the criteria and why we have criteria for people to enter was over the, in a way, it was a response to the clamor to get into these high schools. There needed to be a transparent way in which people were admitted, that it wasn't through any process of cronyism, favoritism, or discrimination that people gained entry. But as we have that, then we have concerns about who gets high scores on tests, who gets rated as a very high performing student when they're seventh grade. And something that I explore in the book that I think is really worth considering is what our grades and test scores in seventh grade can tell us, can tell educators about our capacity to perform well in high school and about our motivation. So the issue comes not so much from the measure, I mean, the measurements itself, yeah, I'm not the first person to suggest that there are a number of measurement flaws with any kind of test or grade used to determine admission to anything, whether it's high school or college. The issue is the scarcity and the competition that gets promoted when there's scarcity. And it's one thing to commit to compete to be able to go to Columbia University. It's another thing to be able to compete as a 13-year-old to be able to go to a high school of one's choice.
Right. So that gets at your It sounds as though it's basically a microcosm of university applications. When you graduate high school, you know, if you want to go to college, you go through a similar process, except of course, a lot happens in the brain developments of kids in grades 9 through 12 that helps prepare them for what's expected of them when they graduate high school. So let's talk about what you did with your book and who were the kids that you spoke with in order to determine how this school choice system in Chicago impacts kids and the very kids that it's supposed to help.
So to talk about the young people who informed this book, who this book is really for and about, these were young people who volunteered. I was fortunate to get funding from the Spencer Foundation for my study. So I was able to offer a pretty modest payment for young people to participate in a series of three interviews with me. I also spent a lot of time in the two schools where I met these young people, observing classrooms, observing high school admissions related events. So the people that volunteered were picked by random, balancing only by assigned gender, and we were dichotomous there, and I know there are different ways that we could have gone about that. But we wanted to just talk to people who were applying to high school, and we weren't so interested in grades or test scores with them, but rather to see if among 36 young people that we randomly picked from the young people who volunteered, what would happen to them and how would it happen? So these were people who were 13 and sometimes 14 years old when we met them when they were in the beginning of eighth grade.
And so I imagine that it was no surprise to you then to find that those socioeconomic factors that students live with and that impact their grades will also, unfortunately, predetermine in many cases how well prepared they are to compete to go to their school, the school of their choice, right?
Yes. And certainly there were young people from low-income families who got into their first choice high school, very high-performing high schools that are ranked not only in the state but nationally, and affluent young people who did not get into their preferred high schools. Hmm. But by and large, being part of a family that has more financial resources was associated in my study with a greater chance of admission to a preferred high school.
And so it sounds as though that it's basically the same kind of inequality being perpetuated.
It is, but there is a special twist in the study because the people who participated were 13 and 14 years old. I don't know if you have a 13 or 14-year-old in your life or if you can remember yourself at that age, but they made very understandable, developmentally reasonable moves that reflected that their brains are still becoming more mature. The system is very complicated in terms of applications because it's such a highly contested and highly surveilled process. There are lots of steps that need to happen in terms of transparency and equitable access to applications that mean that young people have to coordinate a lot of steps to apply to schools, and different schools have different steps involved. Chicago Public Schools, as well as the New York City Department of Education, are taking steps to make this process more streamlined, and I'm really encouraged by those steps, and I think that more steps will need to be taken eventually. It would be hard for me as a person with a PhD who's not 13 or 14 years old anymore to coordinate all those steps and remember everything that had to be done. It is even harder for 13 or 14 year olds. So those young people whose parents could come in, who could speak and read the language in which the forms were printed, and who were confident dealing with school districts and keeping things organized and remembering dates and navigating the internet and finding out not only due dates, but application requirements and when required open houses were to be held at some schools, which was a condition for admission to some of the schools the year that I collected data. Young people who could not count on an adult to do that, even if that adult was passionate about their young child's education and development, but just didn't have what it took to take those particular steps, or even just to bring their child to an open house on a Saturday because they were working, if students couldn't count on that degree of support from their family members and caregivers, they often found themselves, their applications excluded because they weren't complete or they weren't correct, which if you think about a 13 or a 14-year-old, turning in an incomplete application is not a shocking thing to have happen. When parents could swoop in and fix those things, then those errors didn't lead to their applications being discounted or excluded.
Hmm. So essentially, again, you have a situation where those who have that extra support, because they happen to be at higher socioeconomic levels, tend to have that advantage. I mean, I just can't help but think of the college admission scandal in Southern California. We have a sort of epicenter of that scandal where, you know, wealthy elite celebrity parents paid for their kids to get into college when they couldn't get in on their own merits. Of course, that's not exactly what's happened in Chicago public schools, but just, you know, you have those parents who'll go the extra mile, right? And even break laws to get their kids in. It means a whole different world for a certain sector of society.
It is. I was not privy to any law breaking. I was privy to things like young people's parents paying upwards of $400 for one or two courses at a cost of $400 each. Wow. To prepare them for their seventh grade standardized tests. And then again, for the placement exam, specifically for selective enrollment high schools in Chicago, that's a private market option that has, if you think about the free market, very understandably popped up to respond to this demand to compete effectively for access to these schools that thousands and thousands of young people would love to go to. So if you can pay for those tests, you're prepared for things like you can't use a calculator on the high school placement exam. If you know that ahead of time, you get an opportunity to practice solving complex math problems without a calculator. If you find that out the day of the exam, not only are you not prepared, but you may find yourself flustered, which is what people in the study told me. They just didn't know, and that really threw them off. They were in advanced math at their schools. They just didn't know that was something they were going to have to do as part of the exam.
So let's talk about the impact on kids who don't get into their first choice of school. Can you share with me some stories of kids who, you know, were trying to do everything right, and when they didn't get into their school, the school they really wanted to go, what impact does that have on their brains, on their emotional development, and possibly even on their future prospects?
I mean, what I will say is that there are many excellent schools in the Chicago public schools. And many people went into a school and said, you know what, this is just fine. I'm learning things I want to learn. I'm excited about what I'm taking in. Many people did, though, reclassify themselves almost. So thinking about academic identity here, a young woman who we called Atira in the study, who the description of her begins the book. Atira was someone who was just an exuberant eighth grader who said to her interviewer, I just go crazy over projects. She had actually gotten marked down on one assignment because she sort of went beyond the criteria for evaluation and did it the way she wanted to do it. Something that you'd love to see a seventh or eighth grader do, right? To take risks and maybe sometimes take a risk and not get such a high grade, but to see them really expand into their learning opportunities and be excited about those, even if they go a little bit off the rails. Atira's grades did not get her into the school of her dream, but she described with such passion and excitement. And when our interviewer spoke with her in ninth grade, and it could have been a bad day, of course, but she described a series of events and encounters that showed a lower degree of engagement. She knew pretty clearly that her school was not the same as the school that she had hoped to attend. She talked about having to really watch herself and keep to herself to not get into trouble with other peers there because there were issues with violence in the school. And she was so stressed about promoting her classes that art, which was one of her big passions, she had decided about halfway through the school year that she needed to leave the art club in order to focus more on grades. She also described herself as lazy, which is a word I never like to hear anybody of any age say about themselves, but particularly a young person with so much motivation, and particularly a person of color, where that term can be used pejoratively and has, unfortunately, so many times. So she seemed to adjust her academic identity to the reality around her. And I think sometimes, what if Atira had gotten into her dream school? What would she have been telling herself about her academic capacity? What would she have been looking at as her future? Would she still have been part of the art club? Her peer across the city who did end up at that school said things like, "I've yet to meet a mean person. Everybody's so wonderful here." He was a little bit withdrawn himself in eighth grade when I met him, but he had really grown into his new school and was participating in extracurricular activities and was just thrilled to be there. It really was his dream come true. And I think, what if someone like Atira had that experience? And of course, there are Atiras at this particular school. There are kids who make it in, but I think about the kids who don't and where they are developmentally when that process happens, that 13 and 14-year-olds are figuring out who they are, where they belong in the world, where they belong in our city. And as they are reaching for cues around them to help them tell that story, if we give them cues that are negative, there's a chance they're going to believe them. And in Atira's case, it seemed like she really did. I heard other young people who were eligible to apply for some of the top cities, top schools in the city, talk about smarter people in the third person, that they didn't see themselves as smarter people anymore. And there's no way for us to know whether those people are smarter or not smarter. This was based on core grades in seventh grade, core course grades, a standardized test, and a high school placement exam result. And that's all. So I worry about how people see themselves either overly positively or overly negatively because of when this high school admission result hits in their lifetime, in their lifespan.
So you have a very complicated system that's difficult to navigate that can impact students negatively emotionally and sort of set them up for a sense of low self-esteem, which will then in turn impact the kind of college they can get into and potentially just how they see themselves in life. I'm imagining that you're not the first person to point out some of the problems with this system. How are Chicago politicians evaluating the school system and whether this particular setup is working or not? You have a new mayor in Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, who has a detailed plan for the educational system. I couldn't see anywhere in her plan that she might be taking on the competitive school choice program, but I might be wrong. Do you feel that there's any action to fix this situation?
It's very interesting. I've had some great conversations in the last few weeks with different groups of people, both through public book readings and a presentation of my book at one of our nation's top universities a couple weeks ago. And people have asked me a lot of these questions. So what I'll say first is that Mayor-elect Lightfoot did talk in her campaign about her concern over the district investing so heavily in a small number of schools. And these schools are amazing schools. Anybody would want to go to them. The people I know who are at these schools as educators or as students are very proud of what they have. They also know it's pretty rare in Chicago. And that's not to say there are passionate educators at every school. And I really do believe the district is distributing seats at these schools as equitably as they can, given the formula that's in place right now. Mayor-elect Lightfoot said she'd like to see more emphasis on neighborhood schools and less emphasis on these competitive schools. So I'm curious to see how that turns out. And I wrote her and did tell her all about my book. So Mayor-elect Lightfoot, if you're listening, I'm here for you. I want to talk with you more. But in terms of civic action at this point in Chicago, I don't see a whole lot. My hunch about that is it can be such a all-consuming, exhausting, and for many folks, demoralizing process that when they're through with it, they just want to sort of walk away. We also think about people who didn't get what they want and the sort of the ethic in not just in Chicago, but in our society, of not being a sore loser. If you complain about what you didn't get, is that just another way of reflecting negatively upon yourself? Because as we saw with young people, they really held themselves responsible for their outcomes, whether those were positive or negative outcomes. So for people who feel like it was their fault to have not gotten admitted to one of their preferred schools, my sense from talking with them is it would be hard to sort of pick oneself up from that and then go challenge this process because they really believe they got what they deserved. Cut to New York City, though, there are a number of really impressive organizations that put young people's voices forward that are challenging a very similar process there. Hmm. So I want to say the name of the organization is Teens for Schools. I hope I've gotten that right. I follow them on Twitter. They are my heroes. Hmm. They have given Mayor Bill de Blasio, who has spoken out critically of the formula by which young people get admitted to academically selective high schools in New York City. And this group of young people has said, here's how many days there are until the end of the school year. We'd like to see a plan to desegregate our schools. At the same time, the New York City Bar Association has issued a memorandum letter asking the New York Department of Education to discontinue the formula for admitting people using academic criteria to different highly selective school programs there. So that just came out last week. So it's interesting to see how this varies across cities. There is a mayor there who is very squarely opposed to the formula that's been in place, not just because it's been a district policy, but because it is codified into state legislature in New York. So it'll be really interesting to watch the case, but watching this degree of activism that's happening in New York City is both exciting to me to think about what that could lead to. How do people want to distribute seats at these schools? Do they want a different formula? Do they want more schools like this? I'm really curious to see what happens. And I'm also really curious to see the contrast between New York City and Chicago.
It's interesting, right? When we think about the big pictures that we have this patchwork system in the United States and, you know, we, this richest country in the world, just can't figure out how to do it right. And other countries have, you know, there are other countries in the world that offer models where they don't rely so much on this idea of competitiveness and simply focus on learning and how children learn best and fostering their learning and creating an environment where their learning can flower. And I'm wondering finally if you think that this obsessiveness with our individualistic, you know, idea that we have this meritocracy, this ideal that we have this meritocracy that we live in and that everybody can lift themselves up by their bootstraps if they just work hard enough. And this myth in the United States and this rampant individualism and competitiveness really ends up undermining ourselves and our children and the country, you know?
It's amazing to see it. And, you know, I was raised here, although I was raised where everybody where I grew up just went to the same school, and it wasn't the most amazing school in the world. It also wasn't the worst school in the world, and we just went there, and people went their separate ways when everything was done. So this, to me, is something that I've been learning as a Chicagoan. But this sort of undercurrent of individualism, I completely agree with you, Sonali. Like, it really pervades this policy, and it makes it very clear where it's not just that you have to compete against your civic brothers and sisters to get a spot at one of these schools, but it's really portrayed. And I would never say that, I don't think CPS developed this policy to convey this image. I think that we're all responsible for it, to be really frankly. You know, the people who believe in it, who pursue these opportunities for their children and don't think about what that means for everybody else's kids. All of us are in on this one, unfortunately. And when we treat young people as though they are responsible for the educational opportunities that they receive, that gives them a message. That is a civic education for them. It's not civics class, but it's teaching them what they deserve, what they don't deserve, what their country owes to them, what their city owes to them. And these are important lessons that we're teaching. And for me, it's really shown a real bright light on what individualism means on sort of a very day-to-day basis.
Hmm. Well, Kate, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts on this issue. Good luck with the book.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much, Sonali, and it was a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you. Likewise, my guest is Kate Filippo, Associate Professor of Cultural and Educational Policy Studies at Loyola University Chicago School of Education. We've been discussing her new book, A Contest Without Winners, How Students Experience Competitive School Choice. I'm Sonali Kolhatka. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.